Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Last night, Kamala Harris officially accepted the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. She is the first Black woman and person of South Asian descent to be nominated by a major party. She said, quote, "Just imagine Donald Trump with no guardrails and how he would use the immense powers of the presidency of the United States not to improve your life, not to strengthen our national security, but to serve the only client he has ever had, himself." She also talked about Donald Trump's abortion bans.
Donald Trump handpicked members of the United States Supreme Court to take away reproductive freedom. And now he brags about it. In his words, quote, "I did it and I'm proud to have done it," end quote. Well, I'll tell you, over the past 2 years, I've traveled across our country. And women have told me their stories. Husbands and fathers have shared theirs. Stories of women miscarrying in a parking lot, developing sepsis, losing the ability to ever again have children, all because doctors are afraid they may go to jail for caring for their patients. Couples just trying to grow their family. Cut off in the middle of IVF treatments. Children who have survived sexual assault, potentially being forced to carry a pregnancy to term. This is what's happening in our country because of Donald Trump. And understand, he is not done. As a part of his agenda, he and his allies would limit access to birth control, ban medication abortion, and enact a nationwide abortion ban with or without Congress. And get this, he plans to create a national anti-abortion coordinator and force states to report on women's miscarriages and abortions. Simply put, they are out of their minds.
Over the last 4 days, thousands of anti-war protesters marched outside of the convention, demanding an end to the U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza and U.S. arms sales to Israel. On Wednesday, uncommitted delegates, these are the people who voted uncommitted, said they got a call saying Palestinian-American Representative Rua Roman, a Democrat from Georgia, would not be allowed to speak at the convention. Here is Kamala Harris talking about Israel and Palestine.
I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself, and I will always ensure Israel has the ability to defend itself, because the people of Israel must never again face the horror that a terrorist organization called Hamas caused on October 7, including unspeakable sexual violence and the massacre of young people at a music festival. At the same time, what has happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating. So many innocent lives lost. Desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety over and over again. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking. President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and
Representative Rua Roman, a Democrat from Georgia, discussed the decision by the Democratic Party to refuse to allow her to speak.
My name is Rua Roman. I am a Georgia state representative. I'm an elected Democrat. I come from the swing state of Georgia. We are not here to create any divisions. As my colleagues have said over and over and over again, the only reason we are here, the only reason we are here is to ensure that Donald Trump will never make it to the White House and save the lives of the people that we love. It's about the fact that today I watched my party say our tent can fit anti-choice Republicans, but it can't fit an elected official like me. I do not understand. I do not understand why being a Palestinian has become disqualifying in this country. I don't know how much more we have to prove. All of us have decade or more long resumes working for this party because we know that this party is the only one that's ever tried to meet the promise of our country. We are here to literally save the soul of our party. I do not understand why that is a bad thing. This would have truly and sincerely been a beautiful gesture to show this party cares about the cries of an Israeli child the same way they care about the cries of a Palestinian child. We are not asking for too much. All we wanted was to be on that stage and show people desperate for hope. There is something to hope for.
Thanks to Democracy Now! For that clip. That was Representative Rua Roman, a Palestinian-American Democrat from Georgia. CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked Kamala Harris's campaign senior advisor Ian Sams why a Palestinian-American was denied a speaking slot.
Well, I think that we've given them a lot of opportunities to engage in this process at the convention. People have had dedicated panels, for example, during the daytime programming here at the convention to talk about these issues. We're, of course, continuing to engage with the group and make sure that, you know, that the vice president's position on this issue is heard and that their voices are heard and reflected in our convention.
So what did you make of the convention this week? What are your thoughts on media coverage of the convention? What stood out for you? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today we are joined by three journalists. Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic, where he's covered politics and culture since 2015. Hi, Alex. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be back with you.
Great to have you back. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of several books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. His latest book, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Hi, John. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's really an honor to be with you and with my fellow guests.
Thank you, John. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch, a nonprofit newsletter devoted to encouraging political journalists to live up to the highest standards of their profession. Dan has worked at The Washington Post, The Intercept, and The HuffPost. Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Well, before we dive in and talk about media coverage, given that you all write about politics and you've done this for a while now, what really stood out for you over the last 4 days? Alex, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think that what we've seen is, what mostly stood out to me is just the shift in mood. I've been covering this election since it began, whenever you want to say that was. And the mood among Democrats, I think, was rightly despondent, dire, depressed. I could keep using alliterative words to describe it a month ago. And this convention was probably the happiest I've seen Democrats since 2008. It was a really raucous, joyous convention. And I think that what we saw is, a continuation of the kind of vibes-based momentum that we've seen from the Harris campaign for the last month. We've seen a lot of indication that that's the way that they want to continue. I think in general, there was a kind of fighting spirit that Democrats have often been reluctant to show over the last 10 or 15 years that I thought was very heartening. But I also thought that, the handling of the uncommitted movement in particular suggested that, one, I just thought it was shameful. But two, it also suggested to me that a lot of the kind of clumsy political instincts that we saw from Harris in 2020, or more accurately 2019 when she ran, may still be there as well.
What about you, John? You wrote a book called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. You've been to a lot of these conventions. What stood out for you?
Well, I think the fight is still on. So in some senses, this convention was a great progress, right? Evidence of a real movement. In other senses, evidence of many of the things I've written about over the years, the frustrating tendency of the Democratic Party to be slow to recognize change, to recognize progress, to open itself up. And you've already spoken, and other folks as well, about the simple ask of having a Palestinian American on stage. That was, it made it, it's, the thing about it that really struck me was, of course, how dumb the Democrats are, just how dumb they are. You know, cause how the Palestinian folks and the uncommitted folks who were there were unbelievably reasonable. They were literally saying, you know, we just want a speaker. We even can let you pick from many elected folks, and they still wouldn't do it. So first impression, and I'll give you one other one that I think it's hopefully valid. First impression is they're still dumb. You know, and that's tragic really at this point, because it just made no sense. And then the second impression, though, is a much more positive one. And that is, I have covered the struggle within the Democratic Party over neoliberalism for a very, very long time. And there is simply no question that, you know, under Bill Clinton, the party, even a little before that, the party sold out to neoliberalism. It became a ridiculous, awful, embarrassing party that literally would tell working class people, elect us so we can protect you, and then would pass free trade deals that flat out wiped out, you know, factories, communities, put people on unemployment lines. It, you know, it's a terrible, terrible history. And I think this is a convention where, because of the candidates to some extent, particularly Tim Walz, but also because of a shift that began with Bernie Sanders' candidacy in 2016, neoliberalism seemed actually to be pushed to the sidelines. It wasn't at the center of kind of the calculus, and it didn't silence other voices. And I guess the thing that struck me the most was every time someone mentioned the word union, even like when it was Eva Longoria or you know, an actor, an actress, somebody like that, if they said, I'm a union member, the crowd roared with applause. When Joe Biden mentioned that, you know, he'd walked a picket line and liked to think of himself as the most pro-labor president in history, it was one of the loudest rounds of applause that he got as the sitting president is standing down. So that, to me, was beautiful and good. And so I saw some really dumb stuff and some really sad things, but I also saw, I think, progress on the part of working class people in a trade union movement to finally find it someplace within a party that claims to be sympathetic to them.
Dan, what about you? What stood out for you?
Well, first, I agree completely with my most excellent colleagues about everything they said, with one exception. I'm not sure that I would say the Democrats are dumb. I think they're
fearful. Yeah. I'll give Dan that.
I think they're fearful of, still afraid of attack ads. You know, they cravenly, you know, resign themselves to not speaking, not giving a speaking role to someone who speak, not even about Gaza, but just about being a Palestinian. But here's the thing. That was really pretty much it for fearful Democrats at this convention. By and large, it was electrifying. It was joyous, but also muscular. And for me, looking at what the public who, you know, those people who watched it for four nights saw that they would not have known from reading the mainstream media or from watching the network news, is, you know, they got 4 days of reminders that Trump is not just their opponent, but is truly aberrational. You know, I think one of the standout lines was Kamala Harris saying Republicans today are out of their minds. And Adam Kinzinger, the former Republican congressman, I thought was particularly strong. I'm pointing out that the Republican Party is not a conservative party anymore. There's so much attempt at creating a false balance in the mainstream media that I think this notion of just how not normal Trump is being repeated over and over again over 4 days was a very powerful thing.
We've done a lot of shows about media in the past couple of months, and I'm kind of getting tired of asking why the coverage is so bad. But I do wonder what your thoughts are, given that so many reporters were in Chicago to cover this. It's obviously getting 24/7 coverage, you know, even months ago. But overall, what do you think? Dan, you just brought up something about media coverage. Now that things have changed so fast in the last month, what are your thoughts about how the media are covering this race and what is really at stake?
Well, I think it was very hard for anybody in the media to write very negatively about the convention. Where you saw this expressed was in these fact checks that everybody felt obliged to do because they had so fact checked the Republican convention, which was full of lies. And they were trying to sort of show even handedness, and they went to extreme lengths to find trivial little hair splitting differences that they could highlight. It was embarrassing. I wrote about that the other day. I think the coverage for the last 4 days has actually not been terrible. I'm just getting ready for the next part. Already you can hear the media saying, okay, that was fine, but now comes the hard part. I literally got two emails in my email box this morning, one from Politico, one from the National Journal. Harris delivers, now comes the hard part. Harris made history, now the hard part begins. And then the New York Times, I think at this moment, has this extraordinary headline saying, Kamala Harris faces challenge of translating convention joy to fall momentum. What a terrible, terrible thing to have to do. So I think that the media does not want to be seen as taking sides. It's still important to them to be above the fray. But when you've got such an abnormal party running on a basis of lies, it makes it very awkward. But they're still at it.
John, what are your thoughts?
Well, I love being out with Dan because he sums things up so very, very well. And in many sense, obviously, you know, if I was in a courtroom, I would say I embrace that brief. What I think about media coverage is that it is so cacophonous and disparate at this point that it's very hard to say, you know, much about media in general because there really are, you know, different streams and different patterns. There's some very, very good reporting. You know, I do MSNBC now and again, and I was on several times during the convention talking about labor, and that was great. I mean, you know, they were actually interested in what I had to say about, you know, labor unions and what other union folks did, and that's new. Let me tell you, I've been to plenty of conventions where, you know, the attention wasn't there. And to give you one other example, I'm not trying to see everything through my own experience, certainly. We actually, on one of the shows, one of the afternoon shows, had a very, very smart discussion about the fact that this convention really hadn't in any realistic way addressed, the impact of artificial intelligence. Which, of course, is a really serious issue and something that is absurd that they can have a convention at this point where we're going to have this massive societal change and somehow it doesn't come up. And so I guess what I would say about media coverage is that you can find the good examples and you can find the good things in it. What you cannot find is, enough of a thoughtful narrative about, you know, kind of where we're at and what's going on. That gets to, in many ways, to what Dan was talking about. But in a deeper sense, something that of all people, Dan Rather used to do now and again, still around, still a very thoughtful statement. Or a person, he used to now and again, in the midst of a big story, right? He would say, we need to pause and think about what is happening here, right? We need to recognize the significance of this moment. Now that's both in print, digital and, obviously broadcast. And what I mean by that is we have been through a month that a century from now will be seen as one of the most jarring months in the political history of the United States. We have seen an assassination attempt on a former president, the selection of a bizarre candidate for vice president on the part of the Republican Party, a vaguely successful Republican convention that was then thrown off track by a surreal acceptance speech by Donald Trump. And then within hours of that, we learned that the sitting president of the United States is ill with COVID, a disease that still is around and should be taken seriously. And then 2 days later, he stands down, and then within hours of standing down, endorses the first black woman to be a serious, you know, contender for the presidency of the United States as the, you know, eventual nominee of a party, a woman who's a child of Southern Asian and Caribbean immigrants. I mean, just an incredible kind of transformation, opening up of the American political process in ways that people struggled for centuries. And then that woman takes off politically, and then at a point where she's sort of rising fast and getting good poll numbers, things like this, she chooses to accept the progressive choice for vice president, not to go with the narrow Tim Kaine of 2024. And so, you know, this has been an amazing roller coaster we've been on, and we need to put it in perspective, right? And I guess that's my biggest frustration. We tend to be, we're rushing through this moment so fast that we're not recognizing that actual history is taking place almost on a daily basis. And, mm-hmm. and I know we always say it's a historic moment. I cannot emphasize to you, been around for too long. I can tell you, this is a more historic moment. And I wish that we had media that was sufficiently resourced and sufficiently flexible to fully embrace the responsibility of putting this moment in perspective. Whether you do it from a left context or a right context, you know, you can have your ideology, but just some perspective.
Or just a human context, right, John?
I mean,
the thing that
and also, by the way, there's a war in Gaza going on too.
Well, exactly. And also, reporters had access to every major Democrat in this country on the floor.
Yes.
Now, I kept wondering, are they asking, why don't we have healthcare for all in this wealthy country? Why are so many people suffering? The other question I really want someone to ask a high-level Democrat is, why are you guys losing to these people?
I mean, how do you screw this up?
Yeah, we have the Electoral College. We have a different media now. There's a lot of things, gerrymandering, all of it, of course. But I have not heard that question. Why are they losing to these people? Why is this race so close?
But why are you so uniquely incompetent? It would be the question. And I don't interrupt my great colleague here for one second, but let me just follow up on one little tiny aspect of that and simply say that this is the biggest frustration of Bernie Sanders. And I happen to be, we were talking on the phone this morning, just in a conversation on something else. And the senator was, he always says this. He says, you know, I always get asked about what's going on in the moment, right? You know, that delegation moved there, or this guy sat down here or something like that. What do you think about that? And he says, nobody ever says, you know, like, how come this convention didn't take up Medicare for all? How come this convention took opposition to the death penalty out of its platform? Right? I mean, I can think of a heck of a lot of really good questions to ask these folks. And yet, I'll tell you yesterday, you know, the big question all over the place was, do you think Beyonce is going to be here?
Wow. Right.
Sorry to go on for so long.
No, that's, thank you for that. In fact, we're going to do a show about the death penalty and the Democratic Party convention. Thank you for bringing that up. It's so important. Mm-hmm. Alex, based on everything we're talking about here, what would you like to add?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the other issues too, and you saw this at the convention as well, is just that, you know, even with all that many thousands, 15,000 of us gathered in Chicago, you know, the mainstream media in this country is largely in compounds in New York and Washington, D.C., and the extent to which they go out and talk to the actual people who will decide this election in 9 states, essentially, given our perverse electoral system, it's really limited. And it's usually limited to political rallies. It's limited by campaigns that don't want reporters talking to voters. And that, I think, is one of the other issues here as well, is that there's a lack of understanding of the kinds of issues that actually define people's lives. I think that that's, you know, a kind of one of the more under-remarked undercurrents of some of the conversation about the economy, the quote-unquote good economy of the Biden years right now as well. One of the things that stood out to me here in Chicago is just how different talking to normal people was than talking to people in the convention too. You know, obviously the mood inside United Center was jubilant, but, you know, when I would just go out and wander around and eat tacos and their god-awful pizza here, you know, I would hear a very different type of narrative about the kinds of things that were concerning people. And that's an issue as well. To the other question is, I think that there's another thing that's happening, and you saw it. I think that John's in the UC as well, or was in the United Center as well. But you know, the campaign had also given over a huge amount of valuable real estate and access to influencers. I largely found their presence charming, but these people are, you know, being embraced because they're essentially propagandists as well. And I think that you're also seeing an unwillingness by members of the campaign to engage directly. And that also leads to the kinds of opaque and, you know, on this point, at least stupid decision making you saw with regard to the with the Uncommitted movement, because, you know, they're not engaging with people. And I think that they still think that they can kind of control, they can control the narrative via their preferred sources. And, you know, when that happens, you get clumsy decision making like we saw on Wednesday and Thursday.
We're going to take a quick break. On today's Your Call, we are discussing this week's Democratic National Convention. Kamala Harris officially accepted the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. We're also talking about media coverage. We'd love for you to join the conversation. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. Today we're talking about this week's Democratic National Convention. What stood out for you this week? What did you make of the media coverage overall of the presidential race? It's just around the corner. You can give us a call with your thoughts at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And two public service announcements that we're going to repeat in the next few months. Make sure that when you get a text asking for money from a political campaign, if you want to take part, double check it. There's a lot of spam being sent out. I'm getting more texts than ever. So before you share any personal information or send any money, just make sure that it's legit. The other one is be sure to check your voter registration. If you've got loved ones, friends, especially in Republican-controlled states, they are filing lawsuits, and we've done shows. We're going to do more about these lawsuits to kick people off the rolls. So be sure to check voter registration. This is so important. Today we're joined by Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic, John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, Dan Frumkin is an editor of Press Watch. John, you know how these conventions run. Can you just briefly tell us about these delegates? Because these are hardcore members of the Democratic Party, right?
For the most part, yes. You can have a moment of insurgency where you get people who aren't necessarily hardcore members who win primary. You know, somebody like a Bernie Sanders wins a primary, or even, I think back to like 2004, Dennis Kucinich did well in a few states, and you end up bringing people that don't usually end up on a convention floor, right? So it can happen. Jesse Jackson did it hugely in 1988, but by and large, in a predictable year, and this was until last month, a predictable year, you get the usual, right? Suspects. And they're good people. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. They're the county chairs and the state reps and the folks who get up early and stay up late trying to advance their party, right? And it's something they're very involved with. And coming to the convention is for them, both a political act, right? It's exciting and fun because of the campaign that they're involved in and how they want to affect the times in which they live. Many of them are almost always more progressive than the leadership of the party. But it's also fun because, again, you see people they know, right? It's an exhausting sort of fun time for them. And they end up usually paying a lot of money out of their own pocket to stay in overpriced hotels and, you know, the whole bit. One thing that's important to understand about them is that if you want to know who they are, listen to what they applaud. Right? It's a fascinating thing. throughout the convention, because we were talking about Gaza, right? Throughout the convention, every time someone mentioned Gaza and mentioned ceasefire, as Bernie Sanders did, as to some extent Harris did, every time it came up, the whole place erupted in applause. Why? 81% of Democrats favor a ceasefire in Gaza, according to the YouGov Economist poll. Every time the word union was mentioned, like just thunderous applause, right? It was like, these are the overwhelmingly popular things. Now, our media doesn't notice that, right? Our media more often than not says, you know, well, these delegates, they want to win, and they're, you know, I don't know, sometimes they may imagine that they're responding well to some of the more centrist messaging and stuff like that. And so many of the issues that media tends to overcover, the delegates are, that's not where the delegates are at. These are activists by and large. They're not all leftists or anything like that, but they are people who care very deeply by and large about economic and social and racial justice, about saving the planet and about peace. And so that's one of the things I do. I do not sit and watch the convention from the feed outside of the hall, right? Which is many journalists do. They go all the trouble of coming to this thing, and then there are places where they can listen to a feed. There are actually journalists who sit in their hotel room, right? And they think, oh, I'm, you know, writing or something like this. You have to be in the hall. I was there last night. I sat there walked around and talked to people, but for hours, because I wanted to hear how the hall responded. That tells you how the base of the party, as represented by its elected, you know, these elected representatives, how they are responding to the messaging. And what I can tell you is, this is a party, the people on the floor, who really like trade unions. They really like progressive politics, and they would really like for U.S. to change its policy on Gaza.
Well, to that point, we have an email from Carol who says, "While I thought the convention went well overall and was very pleased that Harris chose Walz for her VP, I found that not allowing even 1 minute for a Palestinian to speak on the convention floor became the elephant in the room. As an Arab American, once again, I felt valued less than others in my country. The Democrats denying a Palestinian speaker solidified my feeling that AIPAC is taking over. I have hope for a Harris-Walz administration, but I won't have the naive hope I had when Obama was elected." So to that point, Alex, and I should say we've done a lot of coverage on the convention over the last week. We're getting so many emails on this issue. Why do you think this decision was made? Because you have a wide range of people and organizations, including J Street. J Street describes themselves as an organizer and a mobilizer of pro-Israel, pro-peace Americans. They tweeted that the Democratic Party should host a Palestinian American speaker. Why do you think the Democratic Party made this move, and what do you think it might cost them in November?
Yeah, I mean, the electoral question I'll get to in a second, but I would encourage anyone who hasn't to read the speech, which Mother Jones published yesterday, and which was performed in front of the United Center yesterday at 6 p.m. Central Time, because it is an eminently reasonable speech. It is one that I think it is a plea for common humanity, but it's just a basic recognition of the horrific situation in Gaza. It threads a needle very carefully. It certainly could be much harsher on the Biden-Harris administration's continued arming of Israel, and it's not. It's a very ordinary speech. It would have been profoundly moving had it been read on the stage. It also would have taken 2.5 minutes. And you know, I sat there, you know, in the press seats last night, and you know, certainly watched, you know, a DJ try to pump up the crowd for, you know, at least 40 minutes. You know, I saw influencers who I'd never heard of speak for, you know, at least 20 minutes as well. And so I think that, you know, there are a couple of things. I think one is that there was just an enormous amount of pressure on the campaign from donors and other powerful people within the party to not give in. I think that there's still a larger kind of give a mouse a cookie approach to the progressive left within the, you know, establishment of the Democratic Party, that the anxiety that I would hear, you know, was essentially that, you know, oh, well, if we give them this, then they're going to, they'll immediately just, you know, demand an arms embargo or something. I don't really think that that would have happened here. And I think there was an attempt, at least initially, to spin this, you know, by equating some of the protests that were happening outside the United Center earlier, which, you know, featured more aggressive language with this group. But, you know, anytime you talk to this group, they were very clear that they, you know, they want Kamala Harris to win. They want to be heard. They want to participate in this process. And so I think that what you saw was, yeah, and you heard this from Ian Sams, that, you know, they were trying to deliver these morsels of, oh, you know, we did a roundtable discussion about this at 1 p.m. Well, no one cares about that, right? And I think that that's one issue. The other issue is related to what we're talking about right now, right? Which is that they wanted press coverage of this to focus on Harris's baby splitting message, essentially, that, you know, that the U.S. will always be a stalwart ally of Israel, but also what's happening in Gaza can't continue. And if Harris is elected, she'll stop that somehow. And we don't really know how. But that was the message that they wanted to get out there. And they didn't want it complicated by an acknowledgement of the actual reality on the ground right now and American complicity in that. In terms of electoral consequences, I think we don't know. I think that that's one of the things that the campaign, I think, is really, really underestimating right now, because they've taken this approach essentially that, you know, since Harris took over, it's been a big party, right? Walz's selection was a part of that. And they just want to keep the party going at all costs. And, you know, and I think that the danger is, you know, if you keep the party going for too long, there's often some pretty dire consequences at some point. But, you know, with this question, I think what they're not seeing is, and you didn't see this here in Chicago, frankly, there were large protests, but they weren't huge or headline grabbing ones. But I think that they're really underestimating the student movement that we saw in the spring. They're looking around right now and they're seeing it quiet down. And I think that they're attributing that to the new candidate. And that there's certainly some truth to that, but it's also because it's summer and these kids are home from college. They'll be going back and there'll be more pressure there. And again, I think that the one really, really damning thing about what happened on Wednesday and Thursday with the uncommitted movement is that, you know, Harris's overall approach to Gaza isn't substantially different than Biden's, but the big difference is that she has shown, she's acknowledged the humanity of Palestinians, and Biden, frankly, hasn't. And I think that that has gone a long way to placate folks. But I think by treating this group, this very reasonable group with such callousness, that that's also a signal that, you know, maybe Kamala Harris will be more like Joe Biden than some people had hoped. And that, I think, could end up, you know, an election that will be probably decided by fine margins, like 2020, that could end up being decisive.
And as we're speaking, I just searched Palestinians killed. I mean, what a horrible thing to search. But NBC News, 4 hours ago, Israeli strikes on Gaza tent camp kill women and children. Haaretz from yesterday, 3 Palestinians killed by Israeli drone strike in the West Bank. AP yesterday, Israeli strike kills at least 16 in Gaza. Dan, what are your thoughts here? Why do you think the Democratic Party made this decision? And what do you think it'll cost them in November?
Well, I think it was, you know, what was missing, what felt missing, was an acknowledgement of the incredible grief that many Americans are feeling about the destruction of Gaza and the incredible sense of culpability. But those were not acknowledged at all anywhere in those 4 days. But I can also, I can understand why. It's the one big divisive issue among Democrats. And it's a tremendous downer. So I wasn't surprised that they shut this down. I think it's sad though. And at the end of the day, it's hard to see someone who is a single issue voter on Gaza voting for Donald Trump. I guess the issue is whether they'll vote at all. And I suspect you'll see, just like with the uncommitted, you'll see some number of people deciding not to vote at all.
Right. We have a number of emails actually on Gaza. One listener says, I feel like the DNC could easily have had a Palestinian American speaker talk about what their relatives in Gaza are going through. This would have been a fitting counter to the family of Israeli hostages who spoke. I was hoping Harris would have said nationhood and not just self-determination in reference to the Palestinian people in her speech last night. We've got many other emails about this. I mean, the fact of the matter is, John, or anyone who wants to jump in here, people care deeply about this for so many reasons, but also because we're all watching this happen in real time. I mean, this is really unprecedented that we're watching so much horror on social media because people in Gaza have cell phones. Even though journalists are not allowed to get in, they've got cell phones and they're recording so much devastation.
Well, Rose, you get right to the heart of the thing I've been saying a lot about media since this forum began. And also, it is the answer to your question about the convention, and why the convention didn't do the right thing and why they may not do the right thing in the future, and, or at least in the near future. And that is, the people who run the Democratic Party, senior Democrats, don't spend enough time lying on the couch scrolling through their phone. The way that Americans do, especially younger Americans. I have a daughter who's 20 and she is an incredibly, like all young people, incredibly active, incredibly engaged, doing lots of stuff. But part of her, and it's an odd word for this, relaxation, is that after a busy day, she will, sit down in a chair on the couch and she will, go through her phone, right? And, many of these politically engaged young people and middle-aged people, they follow, a lot of them now follow Haaretz because it does such a better job, but they follow all sorts of different sources and they are seeing these images on a daily basis, right? It forms a part of their worldview. They see it as, consequential in the overall scheme of what's going on, right? As you would about anything you see a lot of coverage of. Joe Biden and a lot of the older players who are in the Democratic Party, it's not like they don't have cell phones. They do, right? But they don't live with them in the same way. And I honestly think this is a media divide, right? It's a question of, are you somebody who thinks, what appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, all the stuff like that, that kind of gives you a sense of the world, right? Versus, do you think it's what's on your feed, on your phone or on your computer or wherever? And that divide, it was writ large in the Democratic Convention. This is still a Democratic Convention, by and large, being run at the highest levels by people or being guided by people who don't sit around and scroll through their phone. And I wish they did. I wish Joe Biden scrolled through his phone.
And the editors of the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, my friend. That's exactly right. And I've said enough here. That's the basic concept is there is a deep divide and it is a generational divide. It's also I know plenty of 80-year-olds who do scroll through their phones and get their information from all sorts of great sources. But it is a divide between people who are getting their information from one place, people who are getting their information from another. And sadly, it is still the case that our major parties are run by people who tend to live in that bubble where kind of like 1990 never really ended. And it's a problem.
We've got another email, and I think these emails are important because it's so important to hear what people are thinking right now. A listener wrote, I am mortified that we may have just lost the election. I woke up this morning happy that we were moving along and making progress from the DNC, only to learn that the Palestinian representative from Georgia was denied the ability to speak. Seriously, are you kidding me? Democrats are defined by their openness, and yet she was closed down and denied. I am of Jewish descent, but I can still think clearly enough to say she had every right to speak. I'm mortified that she could not. Now we're doing the same thing that we criticized the Republican Party for doing. This is total repressive BS. The decision was made to disallow her could cost us the election. I strongly suggest the Democrats find an immediate way to publicly apologize and let her speak right now. Alex, what are your thoughts on this? I'm so shocked that we're not talking more about the Electoral College in these conversations. Because we would be having, we'd live in a different country. We wouldn't be talking, well, we'd be having a very different conversation right now if it were not for the Electoral College. And let's remember, what was it, 40,000 votes? If Trump got 40,000 more votes last time, Biden would have lost. So even if Kamala Harris crushes Trump, depending on the Electoral College, she could lose. Why aren't we talking more about that?
I mean, I think part of it is also because we have a press that's uncomfortable going to places like Dearborn, Michigan, and talking to Arab American voters there, and has not really, you know, there aren't a lot of Muslim American or Arab American people in the press corps who will go and have existing connections there. And our press is, there's an irony in the media coverage in this country in that it is obsessed with electoral results. And I think as the election draws closer, and the reality that this is probably going to be a pretty close election seeps in, that, you know, that will be a major focus of the conversation. And yet, there's little understanding or coverage of the groups that will actually decide this election. And those very much include, you know, the large Palestinian American community in Pennsylvania. There's a large Muslim American or Arab American community in Michigan. And again, and also young people as well. And, you know, just talking to people that I know, you know, I'm in my mid 30s, but, you know, there's, I've seen a sort of slow snap back towards, you know, people just saying that they're not going to vote in November, that they're going to vote, you know, write in someone else, which was the general, consensus, I think, you know, 6 weeks ago, and because of this decision. And, you know, this is not going to go away in the next 3 months, probably. So I think that's one of the other really glaring problems with the decision to ice out the uncommitted movement is that Harris right now, you know, has more political capital to deal with donors and, you know, interest groups within the Democratic Party than she may ever have again right now.
Right.
And I think that this is the moment, if you're going to leverage that, to do it, and the you know, you're for a speech that doesn't do anything provocative, and so there's really no loss there. And I think that, you know, as you know, we will probably see tent encampments sprouting up in the next month, maybe in the next 2 weeks, in universities in both non-swing states like New York and swing states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, even Georgia. You know, this issue is going to come back. You know, the videos from Gaza will continue. There's also the other thing that we haven't discussed, and which didn't really come up in the convention. I should say, too, another mistake that the Harris campaign has made. I mean, along with the omission of the death penalty, was saying that they will not, for instance, push to re-enter the Iran deal. But there's also a possibility that this could, you know, develop into a regional war. A regional war that, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will have to manage. And that, I think, is a very scary situation. And it's a very scary situation electorally. And the Harris campaign seems unprepared for it. But the media has also done a poor job of covering it as well. They did a very bad job. We did a very bad job, you know, covering the student protests in the late spring. I don't see any sign that anyone's learned any lessons from that.
Can I jump in? Go ahead, Dan.
Dan, go ahead. We don't have that much time left, about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I think that one thing the Democrats are hoping is that the issue will go away, and that there'll be some sort of a ceasefire between now and the election. I think, however, that's probably a pipe dream, because Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has no interest in doing it, either because of his electoral issues or because he wants to get Donald Trump elected. And I think that's an issue the media should be writing about.
This is the first time I'm ever going to disagree with Dan. I think that if Kamala Harris continues to do well in the polls, if she gets a big bump out of the convention,
And if there's some evidence that she is, in fact, opening up a lead over Trump, I'm not saying that will happen, although I happen to think it's possible. If she is indeed opening up a lead over Trump, I think Netanyahu pays a lot of attention to that. I spent a good deal of my life reporting, in my younger life, reporting in Israel and Palestine. I've seen Bibi Netanyahu operate politically, and I can tell you one thing about him. He watches American polls more closely than Israeli polls. And if he thinks that there is a chance that Harris might prevail, I do think that there's a possibility that you could see some movement there on a ceasefire. One would hope that, you know, whatever gets us there is good. And so I think there's a lot of factors here that need to be put in play. And I will simply close, knowing we have no time, that this gets to something much bigger, Rose, which is our media doesn't cover foreign policy with the sort of nuance and depth that it used to. It's not that it was great in the past, but it's really missing. And the fact that people don't recognize that what happens in American politics can deeply influence the patterns of foreign leaders before elections is a real error in our media coverage. And I would like to see it be much different, but it won't be different until we fund media at the level where they can have correspondents and people seriously covering things in the ground, not just in America, but around the world.
Well, that was a question we brought up earlier this week, and we'll do more shows about this. If Kamala Harris does win in November, what is her foreign policy going to look like? Are we still going to get $800+ billion military budgets? Half of that money goes to weapons contractors. Last night, she promised to maintain the strongest and most lethal military in the world. And so we will definitely do shows about that in the coming days and weeks. Huge thanks to our guest today, Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic, John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and author of, among many books, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, and Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch. Thank you all for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Lynn.
It's been an honor.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. You can find all of our past shows at kalw.org. Click on News and then Your Call. We are also on YouTube. It's an easy way to listen to the show. You can find that. The account is KALW News. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.